Welcome to Professional Quotient. These are conversations that build equity. I'm your host, Jason Winningham, and today we have a very special guest, Jason Zubchevic. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Would you like to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So you and I went to the same school, TLU, many, many years ago, maybe 20, 25 years, right? Something like that. From TLU, I went to Washington, D.C. I got an internship there with the United Nations. And I started my master's there at American University and then went to Johns Hopkins. To fast forward, had a long career there and recently became the president of the American AI Association and the president of the American Council for Ethical AI. And these are the largest, basically, NGO AI groups that deal with AI and ethical AI in the States.
So tell us a little bit more about those that organization and what it means and what it does.
So the American Council for Ethical AI is a 501c3. The American AI Association is 501c6. The difference is that the one is a foundation and the other one is just a nonprofit. And the American Council for Ethical AI basically focuses on AI projects that are ethical and responsible. So it works with different companies. It works with, collaborates with the government, works with associations to make sure that artificial intelligence that is being used and applied across the board is done in an ethical and responsible way. There are not that many organizations that do that. They are the UN does it to a point. There are a couple of NGOs that do it. But more should be done on this topic, and I can explain why this is important later on. But it's a very important cause that we're working on now. Is you know, people don't see it as important because AI is pretty new, right? People are still learning what AI can do or cannot do. But the more they learn, the more everybody will realize how important is the human element in AI.
Absolutely. I am a huge proponent of keeping the human element involved when we are working with AI. But I'd love to hear from you, if you don't mind, sharing a few, maybe what would be some red flags for unethical use, just to kind of make sure our audience here is on board with us as we go forward in this conversation.
Yeah, well, there are many red flags. And, you know, I studied AI at MIT. And then I studied at MIT. The program was more about, you know, how to create AI, how it works, how to code it and all those things, how to create agents. And when I went to Oxford, the program was more about, you know, the human side of AI and how to use it, how to use it responsibly. What are the ethical elements of it? And that's what prompted me to get involved into the ethical side of AI. The red flags, there are many red flags. I think if people knew how powerful AI can be, I think many people get scared. Because right now we see it as a, like a funky tool. You know, when we started this conversation a few minutes ago before we started recording, you were telling me what you're using AI for. And, you know, you use it for music, for photos, for writing, but those are just some, you know, basic gadgets for that are fun to use, right? Because they help us our day to day. But AI can do much more. And if there's no human oversight over it, that's becomes scary because AI is slowly entering into the slowly entering into the phase where you can think more and more for itself. still cannot do that to you know a wide extent, but it's entering that phase. Whether that's going to be in 3, 5, or 10 years, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't have human oversight, then you're letting AI take over. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, so what are we letting AI take over? Are we letting AI, you know, control our weapons? That's a scary thought, right?
Very, yeah.
Are we letting it control our, you know, smart homes? Mm-hmm. Are we letting AI? So urging companies to implement and create AI that is strictly under human control is very, very important. That's one red flag. If they're not doing that, that's one major red flag. Another one is access to AI. For example, on our board, we have professionals who are involved with the community with disabilities. So are we creating AI that's accessible to everybody, or are we creating AI that's just accessible to certain people, right? Mm-hmm. And how do we do this? If we are only creating AI that's accessible to a small, limited group of people, that's another red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many more flags. I can, you know, you and I can talk about this for, you know, hours and hours, but I would say the human oversight and the accessibility of AI is very, very important. Another red flag is if they're creating AI that's creating, that's generating wrong information.
Or
providing dangerous information, you know, like, another red flag is privacy. For example, many people don't understand that when they're using AI, it's kind of like typing things in Facebook. You know, it's like it's public. You think you're on your computer at home and you're, you know, conversating with, you know, your ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever, and you're thinking the conversation is private, even though they say it's private, it is not.
Yeah.
And the information is often used for training, meaning it, you know, travels to the cloud, and then it can be hacked, it can be accessed. So making people aware that this is happening, I'm not saying it's bad necessarily. Like, okay, maybe people don't mind. People post everything on social media these days, but they have to be aware that that's the case.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And especially in the workplace, like, I just had a conversation with some people who work with confidential reports, and their employees are not even letting them know that they're using AI to like generate summaries or whatever. So they're uploading the reports into AI, right? Into ChatGPT, not realizing that at that point when you upload that information and you tell, you know, ChatGPT, okay, hey, now create me the summary, that report, the entire report is up in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up in grabs. Now, of course, there are different securities, but hey, how many hacks have we heard happening? Yes. It happened in November to ChatGPT, to OpenAI.
Mm-hmm.
So they are happening, they have been happening, and they will happen in the future. So those are many red flags there are many, many more.
You mentioned a number of them, and I think that's a good start just to get people thinking about the importance of this. And you also mentioned twice, I think, that something goes into the cloud. And I think that people still aren't necessarily aware that when somebody says this is in the cloud, it's not magically in the air somewhere. It's literally on a hard drive somewhere else other than your computer. I think that too is a misnomer, where people aren't necessarily aware of the fact that now my information is sitting on someone else's hard drive somewhere. And to your point, they are supposed to be locked down and whatnot. But also to your other point, anything can be hacked, anything at some point. In fact, we should kind of just assume that anything eventually will be at some point. So how are you going to do it? Yeah. So can I ask your thoughts on some of the current trends where people put their own photo in and then ask for ChatGPT to give, I don't know, a holiday photo or an action figure version of themselves? Are they putting themselves in any risk when they do that?
Absolutely.
And what kind of risk?
Well, I mean, we're looking at the right. You're looking at privacy, where the really like you're uploading, let's say, pictures of you know, if you have kids, you're uploading picture of your kids online. It's basically the way we're trying to communicate this. It's kind of like if you're uploading information on Facebook and making it available to everybody, you know. I will say again, you know, if we had somebody from Google right now, for OpenAI, from Microsoft, they'd be like, oh, no, our system is 100% safe. And you can click here and click there. And, you know, there's this security feature. And if you pay for the pro version, then your data is not being used for training. But if you're not paying for the pro version, then it is like a lot of people don't know this. And there, as you said, you know, uploading information on, they can be pictures, it can be reports, it can be, you know, any kind of private information. It can even be a misleading information. You know, like I can go on AI, like let's say, I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but I can say things about you. You know, they're used for training, and then if somebody else searches about you, gets this misinformation about you. You know, so how do you fact check?
So you're referencing when there actually was misinformation put in. I was thinking you were talking about the hallucination that AI can do and fact checking that, but there could be both.
Hallucination is when basically, you know, the way AI works right now, we're talking about generative AI, right? The way generative the LLMs work right now is that, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a computer scientist to figure this out. They're designed to please you, right? So when, right. So you don't have to know Python to figure this out. You know, when you ask for some information, they're like, oh, great question, you know, good job. And then they give you information. And the way it's programmed and designed is to often is to give you an answer no matter what.
Whether it knows it or not.
Right. It's not gonna say, hey, sorry, Jason, I couldn't find this. I mean, it can sometimes, but often it'll be like, oh, Jason, you know, the best thing to do is X, Y, and Z. And then you'll be like, wait a second, I know that Z is not correct. And they'll be like, you're right, Z is not correct, you know? And so it's designed to please. We are working at Ace AI on creating agents that are trained not to please, right?
Oh, neat.
So Ace AI, the American Council for Ethical AI, basically helps organizations with limited resources to get access to ethical AI, right? And the way it works is we take OpenAI the platform, and we create agents that are trained not to do certain things and do certain things, right? For example, we train the agents. It's like, okay, you search information only here, nowhere else, because this information is verified. If you don't know an answer to a question, say you don't know the answer. If you know, are seeking information on X, Y, and Z, ask the user, you know, who they are or what their specific needs are. Don't just answer anything just to please the user. And if the user is not providing you enough information, insist on getting the right information so you can get, you know, you can provide the right answer. So we are working on this. So we're, you know, we are an organization that are not just talking about it, but we're actually creating things. I think that's very important. That was one of my main objectives that you know, there are a lot of NGOs out there who talk a lot, but they're not, you know, creating anything specific. And I said, we have to talk, but we have to also create and lead by example.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you diving deeper into that. Now let's take a look more about your particular role within these organizations and what that how that impacts you as your day-to-day. What does your day-to-day look like?
So, as a president of Ace AI, my main goal and my main objective and my main job that's given by the board is to recruit a strong board for the organization. Basically, what I do is I look at our programs, not the only the existing programs that we have, but potentially future programs that, you know, come from different ideas from the actual board members who are currently on the board. And then I look at different professionals around the country who might be a good fit to champion and participate in those programs, mm-hmm. and grow those programs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically I talked to professionals from, you know, different fields. I spoke with one of the main advisors for AI, President Trump. I spoke with, you know, people who work for the Department of Homeland Security, like station mm-hmm. chiefs, from the FBI, from DOD, from companies like Verizon, Microsoft, Amazon. Mm. And all these professionals have something to offer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to be experts in AI, because AI has been around, you know, like 15 years, but and especially like 2 or 3 years, like intensely, right?
Very intensely, yes.
Not behind the scenes, mm-hmm. the past 15 years behind the scenes, but what these people offer, what these professionals offer, are their perspective on AI and how mm-hmm. AI is impacting their field, right?
Mm.
So how it's impacting, you know, the government is different than how it's impacting company like Verizon, and how it's impacting, you know, Amazon is different than how it's impacting like a nonprofit. So I try to recruit professionals from different industries and different areas that can help guide ethical AI, not just by defining it, but like identifying different areas, different red flags, just like you asked me earlier, like what are mm-hmm. the red flags? How do we address these red flags? Mm-hmm. And then I work with them to identify where they would be the best fit when it comes mm-hmm. to the different programs and activities, and then get references to recruit more members, advisory board members who can fill in other positions that might open or that mm-hmm. Are currently functioning. Honestly, mm-hmm. the response is amazing. Like, pretty much nobody says no, which is...
That's good.
Makes my job easier, right? Makes my job easier. But it's an intense, you know, I'm 100% volunteer in this role, right? Mm. So, my interest is, ethical AI, and pretty much everybody who serves on the advisory board is a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just trying to, do what our mission is, right?
Sure.
So that is pretty much in a nutshell what I do. It's kind of sounds easy, but it's not easy.
No, it didn't sound easy to me, because reaching out to people is a full-time job there. It sounds a little bit like you're a community builder trying to bring people in and get them all working on the same project. I'm curious, as you were talking about that, who or what influenced you to get into this work with AI?
So, about maybe like 3 years ago, there was, you know, when kind of AI was introduced with OpenAI, and it kind of became, you know, more and more intensive. And there was all this talk how everybody's going to lose their job because AI is coming, right? And I became very curious about it. And that's when I wanted to study AI at MIT, and I got enrolled and studied at their executive program. And learn more. I had no idea how it works, right? I mean, I've heard some things, but I wasn't sure, like, okay, what the technicalities are. And I learned a lot, especially because the program was hands-on.
Mm.
And while I was at MIT, you know, studying at MIT, I was also building AI at the same time.
Oh.
And building these agents. Yeah. So it was very practical and very, very, very interesting. But then, and in that phase, I learned how powerful AI is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then when I went to Oxford later at a different program, I got this human element of AI. Like, okay, let's not talk about how quickly we build AI and how well we build AI, but do we build it responsibly? Do we build it ethically?
Yeah.
So kind of like Oxford is it has a different approach. And it was very interesting, and it was kind of like learning through that process was kind of like scary. It's like, cause I learned about the power, but now it's like, okay, it can either destroy us or it can help us a lot, you know? Mm-hmm. And the thing that I learned at Oxford was that, AI will not replace, AI will replace people. That's a fact. But AI will not replace people who know how to use AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is a very important thing to remember. And I'm not talking about just like casual use of AI. I'm talking about like a high level use of AI. If you mm-hmm. know how to use AI in a high level in your job setting, in your job environment, you're not going to lose your job. That's actually going to make you like a superhuman. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to be able to do what 5 or 10 people used to be able to do before.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, or if you resist, eventually you will be replaced. Mm-hmm. A lot of people right now are lucky because a lot of bosses and a lot of jobs don't yet understand the power of AI, so they're not applying it in their organizations and companies. But if they knew and they were applying, a lot of like right now, I would say, I don't know what the percentage would be, but maybe like 20 or 30% of people would be let go right away. Uh-huh. Luckily, it exists, but they don't know it exists. You know, like when something is like for sale, but you don't know it's there, yeah. kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, luckily they don't know, because a lot of bosses, especially like in the association world, the NGO world, and the government, are a certain age where they're not like tech savvy that much. And so they're not applying technology. They're not forced to yet. And so people are keeping their jobs. But, you know, as you said, building this community with people of different professions, like high level leaders, is a challenging process. It's not easy. And especially it's not easy because you get to have like, different personalities, like and I'm trying to balance everything. Like, I don't care if you're Democrat or you're Republican or you're independent, you know, I don't care what your, you know, social opinions are or your mm-hmm. personal or what matters is that if you are for ethical AI, if you're for responsible AI, you are welcome to join, you know. Right. And that is the key. And often we do have advisory members who disagree. They're like, oh, let's, you know, tell the government X, Y, and Z. Let's, you know, go after this company or that company. Or like, look what the Democrats are doing. Look what the Republicans are doing. What are we going to do about it? It's like, it's not about that.
You don't move forward when you have people that are us versus them. You kind of need everybody to work together in order to move forward. You know, that's
exactly right. Mm-hmm. That is it. I think that's the only way we can be successful, right?
And that's challenging for humans in general, because going back throughout time, humans love to put themselves into us versus them categories and divide ourselves up. But I don't think we've ever had something come into our world so strongly as AI seems to be, where now it is. Everywhere you turn around, somebody's implementing more. And it is something that humans should be taking a look at together and saying what is good or what we shouldn't be doing. I'm curious, in a good future state, do you see humans having roles that would be like kind of, we're seeing what the AI has done and now we're approving or we're auditing it and saying, yes, this is approved. Like, are those the kind of jobs that maybe some humans will have if they aren't AI architects, but maybe kind of the other jobs that could be replaced are basically the jobs that could be replaced? Is there an effort to try and convince companies or government to always have a human that makes the final decision, the final approval?
Jason, that's a good question. And, you know, right now everybody's in an AI race. Like, let's do it fast and let's do it, you know, the best and let's do it the quickest. And, you know, our AI can produce it in 1.5 seconds and yours can, you know, in 1 second.
Yep.
And you know, that is great. But the problem is this. Often humans react when something bad and big happens. Yeah. They don't act before, they act after, right? Yes. There needs to be a massive flood and then they'll invest in sandbags, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like they usually, something really bad needs to happen first before humans act. And I mean, there are a million examples.
There are.
Mm-hmm. Right? So I will agree with many of my colleagues that AI is, if not controlled, will destroy humanity. And that's a fact. Mm. Because if we just race without thinking how we can control it and setting up safeguards is expensive, right? Like, it adds an extra layer. So let's say you're, for example, a company who is racing with another company, or, you know, you're a series of companies from one country racing with a series of company from another country to produce better, faster AI. Well, you don't want to add that extra layer. That's going to slow you down, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to do it faster. You want to do it cheaper. And you want to profit more. So who is willing to add an extra layer? What needs to happen, right? What needs to happen before we say, okay, now you must add this layer. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't add this layer, you're going to be X, Y, and Z, right? You're going to be, you know, exposed, prosecuted, whatever. But voluntarily adding that extra layer, it adds costs, slows you down. So, do we need to have people like you? You know, your questions like, are there going to be people who will check? Everybody should.
Yeah.
Are they doing it? No.
No.
What needs to happen for it to happen? Something big and something bad, unfortunately. Mm. How bad? I don't know. I hope not too bad before it happens.
Right. Yeah.
I hope not. And for, you know, for the sake of, is it gonna, you know, I'm 40, 45. Is this, you know, if AI continues to be unchecked, is it gonna, you know, turn into a catastrophe for somebody my age, like in 10, 15, 20 years?
No.
I don't know. I hope not. But for the younger generation, so for sure, there's no doubt. So many jobs are going to be replaced, of course. Many jobs will evolve. And, you know, I think that the safest place for people in their professions, in their jobs, is to learn how to use AI so they can, you know, evolve and transform. Mm-hmm. Sales, as opposed to just fighting something you can't fight.
Absolutely. Always keep learning. Always. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a lot of different times when technologies have come into play where people could dig their heels in and they wouldn't grow. So like when we came out with cell phones, you know, you could have clung to your landline at your house and said, I refuse, but now you wouldn't really be engaging in the world the same way if you didn't adopt that. I mean, there's a lot of different examples. That was the first one that came to mind. I'm curious, what would you say is your advice to those that are maybe completely novices with AI? They know it exists, but they really haven't engaged. Where would you say they should get started getting to know it?
I think it really depends on like what they're, you know, if they're employed, right? If they have a job, to see what's the best way to use AI in their profession. Like what tools are the ones that are helping them? Then that's, you know, available everywhere. You can find this information. Mm-hmm. You don't need like a special source. And then kind of start working with those tools. you know, just like you told me, you know, you're experimenting with the music AI, right? You're experimenting with pictures, you're experimenting with generative AI. So experiment and learn as much as you can, right? Mm-hmm. To whatever applies to your work. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't apply to work, you don't have to, unless it's like a, you know, hobby or you're curious. Mm-hmm. But the best start is what's going to help you with your job. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to start. I don't think you need to do more than you need to know, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's what I would say. Just be curious, you know. If I could give advice, be curious and try the tools that apply to your job.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good. Solid advice. And on the Professional Quotient show, we always like to highlight the aspects of our personal portfolio of professional equity that basically goes with us from profession to profession. These are our skills, our knowledge, our experience, our education, and the community of people or our network that we built up. With those things in mind, what would you say in your world has the most value to you right now?
I think the most value I would say the relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, relationships are very, very important. I, you know, the more I know, there's this saying, you know, the more I know, I realize I know nothing. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I try to learn as much as I can from my connections. I often, this is an exception, I often try to speak less and listen more, because I get to learn more, and that gives me more power in everything I do. So to answer your question, I think the connections with people, and that's why I love building new connections, is very, very is very, very valuable to me.
Absolutely. And are there activities you do specifically with that aspect of your network and your community? Are there activities that you do to build your network? And if you wouldn't mind sharing what those are.
Many, many different activities. I'm involved in all kinds of stuff. We can, you know, talk about it all day and night. I do a lot of, you know, volunteer work. I reach out to people that have some sort of connections with me, whether like educational, you know, connection or professional connection or any kind of volunteer work. First I focus on doing something that we find in common, but then I look forward to expanding that relationship and doing, you know, other things. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's
so getting involved.
Getting involved, yeah,
okay.
For
I
sure.
Like that.
Especially with volunteer projects. I think, you know, I'm in when you're very, very young, you kinda just pursue your own things and you're trying to survive, right? But when you're past 40, past 50, you start thinking like, okay, how can I help? How can I contribute? Mm-hmm. And that's how you start getting involved more in volunteer work and helping others to achieve as much as you have or more. Mm-hmm. So I would say those activities are very, very important and very productive too.
I'm a huge proponent of volunteerism. I think it's a wonderful way to build our community of people around us, because you end up meeting people that you wouldn't meet during your normal like 8 to 5 or whatever job you do or any other organization. We become kind of siloed as humans. Like we only see the people that we see because that's my workplace or that's my church or that's my organization. Right. But when we get involved with volunteer organizations or anything extracurricular, really, we start meeting new people outside of that community. And that's how we really start to grow and build that network. So
I couldn't agree.
Yeah, I appreciate what you shared there. And volunteerism is a great way to do that. Another thing we like to cover on the show is that each person at some point in their careers, specifically in the professional world, will experience a challenge that they have to overcome. Are there any challenges that you don't mind sharing and specifically to show us how you overcame that challenge?
Sure. When I went to business school, when you get out of business school, you often think about, okay, how can I open a business, right? Because you know, business school is about that, like opening businesses, running businesses, and so forth.
Sure.
And I think if somebody goes to business school and gets their MBA and then doesn't try to open a business, it's like a wasted opportunity because you learn so much during the MBA mm-hmm. program. So when I went to do my MBA, when I came out, I was like, okay, I'm going to open a company. And my idea was to open a company that's basically a marketing agency. So having different marketing services. And the challenge was, well, there are a million marketing firms everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sure. When I spoke with people, they were like, come on, Jason, like, you know, what are you thinking? Yeah, like you're wasting time because there are hundreds of companies just in your town, in your city. You know, imagine New York, there are like thousands, and, you know, LA and Chicago and blah, blah. And don't waste your time. But how I dealt with that challenge, I'm talking about competition, right? Mm-hmm. How I dealt with the challenge of competition, or like there's too much of something, was that I did not even think about my competition. I just focused on my thing.
Nice.
Because if you wake up in the morning and you start thinking, oh my God, there's this guy, and then there's that guy, and then there's this, and there's that, and there's this company, and there's that company, and you'll never do anything, right? You'll get scared. You're like, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to sit and do nothing. But mm-hmm. I did not even think about them. I started the business. I reached out to a bunch of potential clients and got five companies who became clients of my company. And then everybody was wondering, like, oh my God, like, you are so lucky. How did you get five of these companies to be your clients? And my secret was, well, I asked 1,000 companies and five said yes. But nobody knew that. They thought that five and five said yes. It's not like that. You got to ask 1,000. And, you know, if you get a 5%, like 0.5% response rate, that's good. If you get 1% response rate, that's fantastic. If you get 3% response rate, that's like unbelievably good. I'm talking about when you start a business. And 3 years later, we're working for the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. We're working for Elevation. We're working for major associations. Like, they're all our clients. And people are like, oh my God, like, you're so lucky. Like, how did you do it with all the competition? And we just didn't think about them. Like, it's good to analyze your competition and see like what they're doing, what they're not doing, but you don't wake up every day and start scaring yourself. Like, so the challenge is every day you're going to face competition every day in anything you do. Don't waste your time thinking about like, oh my God, they're going to, run me over. They're so much better. They got this one and I didn't get that one, blah, blah. They're using this technology. I'm not using that technology. Just focus on being the best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're focusing on being the best, one day you'll go out on some expo or something and you'll see your competition and you'll see that you are the best. And you'll be like, oh my God, look, So it'll encourage you to do your best and not think about what others, are doing or performing or whatever. So that's the challenge. One big challenge I had that I overcame, but by ignoring, not really ignoring, but not overthinking.
Sure. Yeah. And having resilience to keep going in the face of what you were saying, 1,000 companies and five said yes, but that means a lot of them said no, and not letting no be the end.
Absolutely, Jason. That is. I'm glad you mentioned that. And that is also the key, right? So, like, if you are, you get two no's, and that puts you down for the day, then don't do it. Like, just do something else.
Find something else to do. Yes.
Because, getting a no, and getting a no is a positive thing. Because if you get a no, ask why you get a no. Like, they'll tell you, well, no, because of X, Y, and Z. And maybe that no is a soft no. So maybe like in 6 months, contact them again. Maybe it's going to be a yes. Like, look at from your point of view, you know, when somebody asked you something at some point and you said no, like 3 months later or 3 years later, you might say yes to that thing. Like, you don't know. Maybe your things have changed. Maybe your budget has changed. Maybe your, you know, personality has slightly yes. changed. Who knows? So many people, maybe, and I've noticed this, you know, and let me know if you have or haven't. But you know, when you send an email, like in our culture, in our American culture, when somebody sends you an email, it says, "Hey, Jason, how are you doing?" And blah, they probably want something or need something, and like, and you don't reply. They don't send any more emails because it's rude, or phone calls or whatever. But the ones that succeed will send you another one. But I'm not talking about spamming. I'm talking about like reaching out and get an answer. Yeah. And you're like, "Hey, Jason, I didn't hear from you. Mm-hmm. Like, are you, you know, just let me know. Like, are you a firm no on this?" And you say, "I'm firm no, don't call me again." Fine. Okay. But if Jason says, "Hey, Jason, I'm in you know, in a bad spot right now. Contact me in 6 months," write him in 6 months again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to reframe no as K-N-O-W. Like, when you hear a no, it just like you're saying, you need to know, what do I need to know about this? Not, don't just hear the N-O word. Reframe it as a K-N-O-W. So
you can learn from anything. You're absolutely right. That's a recipe for success. And I'll add another thing, Jason.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, sometimes people like go and try something and they're like, okay, I'm going to follow this recipe of not giving up. And then they continue. But that thing doesn't work. It's like, it just doesn't work. Well, you need to be flexible and say, okay, I tried this. There's solid reasons why this doesn't work. I'm going to try something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not be afraid of like changing things and seeing, like, if you see the most successful people in the world, they try many things. They don't try one thing. Yeah. They try to get this tool, it fails, then another tool, then that's a debacle, then another tool, and then, you know, it bankrupts, and then they try another one, and then that one is fine. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so there are many different factors there that you have to take. Like, don't give up, but then try different things at the same time. Like, all these things go together, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to be successful at something, mm-hmm. right?
Sure. Thank you for that. A lot, I'm sorry. Within each of these shows, I always ask for our guests to have an opportunity to spotlight or highlight anything at all that they'd like. What would you like to spotlight?
Well, I want to use this opportunity. When we started the conversation, you told me that I can highlight something about my profession and sure. my line of work. I would like to highlight the importance of AI to the listeners to this. AI is coming very fast, and you need to get ready. Mm-hmm. You need to get ready, especially if you're younger and you're starting your career. Everybody should get ready, but especially if you're younger and you're starting career, because it's going to have a huge impact on you. Mm-hmm. Don't hesitate. Get educated. There are many, many good programs that are practically free that you can attend. It doesn't have to be Harvard, MIT. There are other programs that are equally, you know, good, and you can learn a lot, and that can help you down the road. Mm-hmm. I think that AI is unstoppable. That's a fact. It's in our lives. It's going to be in our lives more and more. And I will urge everybody to get educated and equipped, and to do it in an ethical and responsible way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And are there ways in which people could get connected with you or support your organization? And how would they reach out?
You know, anybody can contact us. We are a nonprofit. They can get involved. Right now, our organization is heavily focused on professionals in different fields. But definitely, anybody can contact us with different ideas, with different you know, concerns that they might have, or anything like that. We're, you know, we are open to communications, because I think communications is the most important, one of the most important aspects of doing our work.
Sure. And what would be the best way for them to find your organization?
I think, I mean, online, you know, if they just Google American Ethical AI, we come up first.
Perfect.
You know, they can contact us on, you know, by phone, by email, by the web form that we have, or they can contact one of our board members. We're definitely open to communications with and partnering up with people that have good experience and are willing to implement our mission.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jason, for coming here and sharing your insight, your knowledge, and really your motivation for getting people to learn more and get involved. So thank you for that.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Absolutely. And to our guests that are listening, remember that these shows for our Professional Quotient are brought to you by MarketScale, our sponsor. So please check them out and be sure to like, share, review, and subscribe to the show. And remember that unlike our IQ or our EQ, we can really easily raise our PQ every single day. We just have to keep learning, building, and connecting. Until next time.